This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak again to Karen Barth Menzies at Baum Hedlund about current litigation pending in the subject of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Welcome back to Utopia Medical News Network.
Thanks, Mark.
Why don't we start with the big class action suit? It's not exactly a class action suit, you could clarify that, but an action of a lot of people against GlaxoSmithKline for allegedly addicting thousands of people to the Paxil drug product that they produce and sell.
Right. We're actually the lead counsel in that litigation. It's called a MDL, or a multi-district litigation, and all that means is that the thousands of individuals who are pursuing litigation in various states around the country have all been coordinated together into one judge's courtroom out here in Los Angeles.
So strictly speaking, it's not a class action suit, but it's a consolidation of multiple cases.
That's correct. There are some of the cases that have been brought to L.A. still include some class action, class allegations.
Right.
But it is thousands of individually named people as well.
Okay. How many individually named people?
I think it's around, we keep getting more each month, being added in. So I would say we're somewhere over 2,000, and it'll likely get to around 4,000 or so.
Okay, and what is that group alleging?
They're alleging claims for compensation related to their addiction, their dependence, and withdrawal symptoms when they were trying to come off of Paxil.
Okay, now how much of your work is working on the sort of the science and the medicine, and how much is working on the legal principles, and how much is kind of logistics of coordinating a suit that big?
It's all of the above,
right.
But that's definitely what's required in litigating these types of cases, is specializing and getting very deep into the science of the actual drugs themselves, and we've been doing it for over 12 years now, and so have developed that specialized knowledge. But it can be a very complicated case if you're not familiar with that science, and it's easy for the drug companies to sort of pull stuff over you if you don't have the experts and the knowledge behind the drugs themselves.
Right, and you have experts lined up who can clearly. Is this going to go before a judge or before a jury?
It'll go before a jury.
Okay.
And yes, we do. We've been working with some. World-renowned experts in this litigation for a number of years now.
What's the timetable? When do you expect the next thing to happen?
Well, we have this is a unique coordination of all these cases. Normally, it's done early in the litigation. This time, it's done a little bit not quite as early. We've been already litigating these cases for 3 years now, and so we've been developing a lot of the discovery against GlaxoSmithKline related to the dependence and withdrawal issue. But that discovery is going to continue on with all the cases coordinated together. So those people who are bringing their cases in now to the MDL will have the benefit of that previous work that had been done, and then we'll continue forward.
So you'll essentially make available all the information you've got to everyone in the case.
Right. That's part of the MDL process, so that they can coordinate the efforts and have it a little bit more organized and centralized.
Okay. Now, if you can talk about it, have you discovered smoking capsules, so to speak, of internal documents saying that they knew about it, they didn't care about it, or anything like that?
Absolutely. And a lot of the stuff is confidential. However,
right.
we are very confident on the documentation that we have related to their awareness and the fact that that withdrawal and dependence occurs, how bad it is, the level of intensity, and the very high number of people taking Paxil will suffer these side effects, and the fact that the drug companies have known this for a long time.
It sounds like some car companies that had exploding gas tanks, and they said, well, it'll be statistically insignificant, so.
Right.
How does the case that you're bringing here but you didn't answer the question about when you're going to be in court next and what happens then?
Well, right now, the court's still struggling through the effort that's necessary to organize that many plaintiffs.
Right.
So we'll be in court in July for what's just called a case management conference, and
right.
That's where we'll meet with the judge and try to create a plan, a schedule for how the rest of the litigation will play out.
Okay, and that's here in what? Which court, where?
It's Judge Falzer's court here in the Central District of Los Angeles. That's a federal court here.
Federal court, okay. Now, how does this case have a name, a lead plaintiff or something?
Right, it's called the... I'm trying to remember because they changed the name. Oh yeah,
right.
The Paxil Products Liability and it's MDL number 1574.
Okay, so it's called the. It's not named after a person. It's the Paxil Products Liability case.
Correct.
Okay, how does this case, this Paxil Products Liability case, relate in substance and in process to the case being brought by New York's crusading Attorney General Elliot Spitzer against the same company, GlaxoSmithKline, for fraud in their sale of Paxil?
They're related, but they're not. The distinction there is that the Attorney General's cause of action is more for injunctive relief and restitution, and what that means is the state is looking to get back the money that was paid out for a drug that what they're saying is has been fraudulently marketed, not only with the failure to inform the people of the side effects, but also a failure to inform people of the marginal efficacy, and that means, you know, is it effective, and it's not very effective, and so what they're attempting to do is get the price of that drug that was paid out after all these years and all the money that was made by GSK back for the state and its residents.
Now, what's the, only for the residents, only for people in New York State who were affected?
For that case, right. However, we're involved in similar types of cases, out here in California and some other states as well. Again, the way to distinguish them is a consumer protection type case versus a compensatory, like a personal injury type of case.
Okay.
So it's, I know that's sort of legal jargon.
Right. No. It means that the state is suing for bad marketing practices, and you're suing for personal injury, essentially.
Correct. But although we ourselves have other separate suits that where we're also suing them for bad marketing practices.
Right.
The way to distinguish them is the money that's obtained in those cases, if and when they're successful, will not cover. They're not designed to cover the injuries that people suffered. It's designed to cover the disgorgement of profits and the unfair, ill-gotten gains.
Right.
Think of it that way.
Now, what's the timing? Do you know what the timing is with the New York suit?
It's just in the early stages, and the attorneys there, I've talked to them. I think they're expecting GSK to try to remove the case to federal court, which will take a few months. They're confident that they can get it back into state court, but that itself will cause at least a few months delay, and I think that's what GSK wants to do, that is get the attention off of the case and delay it for as long as they can. That's a common drug company tactic.
Now, will any findings in their case be useful for you and yours and vice versa?
On a general level, but none of them would be binding because
right.
It's a different jurisdiction.
Right, it's not precedential, but
correct.
There might be information uncovered that would be useful for the other case.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Is either Elliot Spitzer or you in your case asking that Paxil be taken off the market?
No, and that's not what the allegations are designed to do. That's a decision that is not made by any of the attorneys or as part of the litigation. That's a decision that's made through the regulators. So, no, we're trying to get compensation for the victims and trying to get recovery for the ill-gotten gains.
Okay, we've got these big cases that have thousands of plaintiffs or a state involved. Well, let's talk a little bit about another kind of case that also involved SSRIs, namely suicide and suicide attempt cases. What drugs have been involved in those?
All the SSRIs have been implicated into a concern about suicide and violence. And the cases that we've been handling primarily are the Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft cases.
Okay, and there's a specific case involving a woman in Minnesota who's suing for I'm not sure exactly what the claim is, but it's because her husband committed suicide on an SSRI.
That's correct. It's a wrongful death claim for his ingestion of Zoloft. He had
who is this? What's the case called? Who's involved?
It's Kim Witzak is the plaintiff,
right?
And her husband Woody,
right,
had been taking Zoloft for a few weeks, and actually the doctor increased the dose, and Woody, who had no previous suicidal ideation or even a history of mental health problems, killed himself.
And these were free samples that he took, right?
Correct.
Okay. And where does that case stand?
Well, it's just in the early stages. We just filed it, so we're going to go through some early fights. We're fighting Pfizer in the Zoloft cases, numerous in numerous different jurisdictions around the country. And their first effort typically is to try to argue to the court that the court has no say over this type of a claim, and it, because it's what's called preempted by the federal regulations and the FDA. And that,
right.
And basically all that argument is in a nutshell is that the FDA, they argue that the FDA, because they approved it, huh. And with the label that was on it, the warning that was on it, that doesn't mean that you can second guess and say that the drug company failed to warn about the side effect.
So essentially preempts, and the same argument that if the federal government requires a cancer warning on cigarettes, if someone smokes a lot and dies of cancer, the states can't have action against that because it's been federally preempted.
Correct.
What do you think of that legal argument?
Well, it's interesting because that brings in a huge controversy. A couple years ago, Pfizer's lead litigation counsel, Malcolm Wheeler, had contacted the currently appointed chief counsel for the FDA, Dan Troy. They know each other, and he called him up and said, "Hey, I need help in one of these wrongful death Zoloft cases. Can you file an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court brief,
right,
against these consumers on behalf of the FDA and in favor of the drug company?" Dan Troy went ahead and did that, and in that amicus brief argued that the FDA, even if the drug companies wanted to warn about suicide or violence, the drug company or the FDA would not allow them to do so. Now, over the course of the last year, I'm sure many of your listeners have probably heard that the FDA is now requesting that the drug companies warn about suicide.
Well, let me ask a little more specific about that. I've been trying to get some more information about that from the FDA with no success at all. They issued what they call a talk paper.
Uh-huh.
And the talk paper says you might want to think about putting stronger warnings on your labels saying that there's a risk of suicide and you should watch for it, and especially in adolescents. And I've asked them how many drug companies have heeded that talk paper,
mm-hmm.
and they won't tell me. And I've since heard the term agency action, which is something they could have taken instead that would have required the companies to put a warning on their labels, but instead they issued a talk paper. What's happening with that exactly, both sort of legally and in practice? Are some drug companies updating or upgrading their warnings?
Yes, they have. The difference between it's sort of a softer way that the FDA has decided to deal with this issue, and that is rather than the agency action. But that request for a warning is a very strong statement by the FDA saying that they do think that there needs to be a warning about suicide at this point in time. That's never happened in the past, and that's a significant turn of events.
And does that provide fodder for your argument in court?
Well, it certainly does, and it definitely helps us argue that the FDA does, in fact, think a warning should be involved, so we can. It helps us with that Dan Troy and preemption brief, for one.
Okay.
So once the warning was out, the FDA asked for this on March 22nd, and a couple weeks ago, most of the drug companies who have SSRIs or the other types of drugs like Wellbutrin that aren't technically SSRIs but they're in that same class,
right,
have all warned now, have added a warning to their label, and other than Pfizer and Lilly.
Pfizer makes Zoloft and Lilly makes Prozac.
Correct.
And they haven't put that warning in.
They've not put the warning there, and the egregious thing about that is the fact that Pfizer is warning about suicide in Canada. So
well,
I don't know what makes it justifiable here that our doctors here don't need that same warning.
Well, one of the things we're not going to talk about today is buying drugs from Canada. So that means if people violate the FDA rule and buy that drug from Canada, they will get a warning in their package, maybe.
Right. I mean, it just really shows that Pfizer, you know, they're getting away with whatever they can, and the FDA is miserable in trying to police that. The SSRI drug manufacturers in any effective
right.
way.
Could you be more specific? You've testified, I think, at length before the FDA. Where are they in all this? Are they friends of the consumers? Are they just plain out friends of the drug companies? Are they?
When it comes to this class of drugs, the SSRIs, they're friends of the drug companies, absolutely. And the actions that those individuals at the FDA take consistently and continuously are speaking at seminars and doing whatever they can to promote more prescriptions of these drugs, to promote more advertising for these drugs, not what their real role is and should be, and that is to protect the consumers from over-promotion of these drugs. I think that boils down to a handful of individuals, namely Dr. Bob Temple, Peter Pitts, Russell Katz, Tom Loughran. These are all individuals who have been involved with the SSRIs from pre-approval, before they're even approved. They helped them get approved when the issue of suicide, the risk of suicide, came up back in 1991. These very individuals did not force the drug companies to do anything about the risk of suicide. They looked the other way, and they're continuing to do so now, 10 years later, 12 years later.
Have any of them worked for drug companies, or any of them planning to work for drug companies when they leave the government?
It will be very telling once they leave the companies where they, or once they leave the FDA, where they go. There are others like Dr. Paul Lieber, who was with the FDA. He's now a consultant for drug companies.
Okay. Speaking of overzealous marketing, you've said some things in the past about the marketing departments at these drug companies creating illnesses, social anxiety disease, for example. What's the situation with that?
Well, part of the promotion of these medications and their efforts to increase their sales is to market not only the drugs but also the diseases. So if they can get out there and continuously make statements that that there's different types of diseases like generalized anxiety disorder or socialized anxiety disorder, you know, that disorder that they're describing, if you see the ads, a lot of people have the same reactions. Like, well, anybody could have that problem at any given time in their life. I mean, it basically describes everyone.
It essentially medicalizes normal human conditions.
And emotions and behavior,
right.
and advocates giving you a psychoactive drug that blunts your emotions and your ability to handle those situations through a natural development process. And the scariest thing about that is they're doing that with kids.
Right.
The highest number of prescriptions right now that's increasing are preschoolers.
Right. And so rather than using that anxiety as a bridge to social development, people are having that essentially taken away from them so that they never do that social development, and then they continue to have post-childhood drug use syndrome, which they'll have to treat with new drugs, presumably.
Yeah, presumably, because then they're going to have the long-term problems of these medications, including the inability to get off of them.
All right, let's talk about, right, and then they'll fall into your category of plaintiffs there. Two important things. Are these, I know it's, well, maybe it is okay to talk about all these drugs together, but the two issues, essentially, efficacy and also what you were talking about, withdrawal. Are these drugs, from the evidence that you are knowledgeable about, useful in treating even the less disputed diagnoses that they're being prescribed for?
Like depression.
Depression, right.
No, what the evidence of that is, there's been numerous studies now showing that the placebo has a stronger effect. The placebo is oftentimes more effective than the drug itself. There's studies showing that exercise and change in diet helps with depression far better than, and that's without the side effects of the SSRIs. But what's happened in the last few months is what we've been seeing, you know, quietly in the litigation for years, and that is that when this class of drugs were approved back in the late 80s and early 90s, they were approved when there was very marginal proof of effectiveness. And even the FDA themselves, when they were approving these medications, and we have the documents that show this, stated that they were fearful that they were going to be questioned or criticized for approving the drugs when they had such a low level of effectiveness. They anticipated what's now happening. Then you have the scientists in the UK that took a look at the SSRIs and all the studies that were done for kids related to the SSRIs to see if they were in fact effective, and they found that they weren't. So that's the clinical trials as done by the drug companies are showing that they're not effective. And when you couple that with the high risk, with a risk of potentially fatal suicide or violence causing homicide, It's just not worth it.
So, in fact, to summarize, we've got drugs that have no positive effect on the diseases that they're recommended for or prescribed for, that have, and that's been established in tests in the United States and in Great Britain, and that they have a powerful capability of addicting people, and that if you try to stop taking them when they have no effect and they've addicted you, you get withdrawal symptoms, and they cost a lot of money. This doesn't sound like something that ought to be as popular as sliced bread.
It's been a very extremely successful promoting campaign. The one thing you want to remember, though, and people who hear this will and I hear this all the time, dispute and say, no, this drug was wonderful. It totally helped me. It's not to say that the drugs aren't strong.
Right.
Okay, you definitely feel an effect the same way you would anything else that gives you a psychoactive, euphoric effect.
Right.
But whether it actually helps the depression more than, say, the placebo effect, and that would, you know, that when they look at that, they look at the involvement of a counselor, somebody talking to you, or actually addressing your problems. They can't distinguish which is being more helpful, the drug or the placebo effect.
Right. In other words, if you give someone a bright pill and say this will cure your depression,
and they feel that something physiologically is happening to them because they're taking a drug that makes them high.
Right. And speaking of high, the action of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors is essentially the same action of LSD, isn't it?
Generally, I mean, they have made comparisons, and that's when I use the term psychoactive. The street drugs that you hear about,
right,
those are also psychoactive, and all that means is it fluctuates your brain chemistry.
Right.
In a way that it causes you, you know, mentally, euphorically, to react.
Okay. A man named Tom Sneeden, who I actually introduced, who I interviewed, has set up a program called Academic Detailing, in which teams of essentially anti-detailers go around with information about to doctors about how to maximize outcomes rather than how to inflate drug company profits. Are you involved with that at all? Is this a good idea? Is this a sort of complement to litigation?
I'm not involved with him, but I'm thrilled to hear it. I've been asked a lot whether we think that those drug companies that are following the FDA's request for a suicide warning, will that help? Will it be effective? Not just by changing the label, it's not going to be effective, I don't believe, but what they need to do are similar to what you're referring. They have to have, the drug companies should be required to re-educate the medical profession to get them an accurate understanding of what the efficacy, the effectiveness, and what the risks are related to these drugs, because they've had an inaccurate misperception throughout the last decade or so, and the only effective way to re-educate these people are to bring detailed people in and tell them both about not only the good sides but also the bad sides of the drugs.
Do you have sort of a ballpark figure about how much money the drug companies spend to advertise and promote their SSRIs?
I don't have a direct number for you, but I know it's a lot, and it's increased extraordinarily since about 1997 and 98 when they allowed the direct-to-consumer advertising.
Right.
And I think most people can attest to that, because we've pretty much now all have seen
the
increased marketing that's being done about these medications.
I feel so sympathetic to that little bubble in the Zoloft.
He's
so cute. You want to step on it? Okay. The National Association of Attorneys General just settled a case against Pfizer.
Yep.
Makers of Zoloft, for illegally promoting the off-label uses of Neurontin, which is an anticonvulsive. Pfizer agreed to pay $430 million, including $38 million, to underwrite what seems like a giant academic detailing project. Are off-label abuses also prevalent with SSRIs, such as Pfizer, the same company, Pfizer Zoloft, GlaxoSmithKline, Paxil, and other SSRIs?
Absolutely. And the way they effectively achieve that is by promoting the drug without telling the doctors of its marginal efficacy and the high risk, so that doctors are comfortable with prescribing this medication for any type of problem a person has. Oftentimes they aren't prescribing it for depression or even mental health related problems, and that's all off-label prescribing. But if the doctor feels safe doing so because they don't have a concern that there's any risk, and they don't have an awareness that it's really not an effective drug, then they're going to prescribe it.
It's a little slightly analogous, I think, to giving people antibiotics for flu.
Right, right. Yes, but it's a direct result of over-promoting the drug.
Right, okay. We've been talking back and forth a little bit between these big cases and the individual cases. You're also involved, I understand, in the Pittman case in South Carolina. What happened there? What's your role? What are the allegations or what are the charges?
This is a boy. It's a criminal case. It's a 12-year-old. He was 12 years old and was on Zoloft for about 3 weeks, and he killed his grandparents. And he's a kid who had, generally a good kid, hadn't had disciplinary problems in the past. He started taking Zoloft, and it really changed his whole manner of acting. People who saw him and knew him from before described him as suddenly becoming hostile, unconcerned about any of his circumstances, just kind of a jerk, where before he had been a polite kid.
Right.
And that all came to a head. He described, hearing voices in his head telling him that he should, go kill his grandparents. And,
right.
and that's what we hear when people who are suffering this side effect of suicide, both suicide and violence, what they hear is... It's almost like a hallucination. They hear in their mind that they should either kill themselves. It sounds like a good idea. I had this desire somehow from somewhere to kill myself,
so,
and oftentimes in a violent way, or to kill others.
So, in fact, as a drug experiment, we're finding one of the effects of these drugs is to give people these kind of hallucinations.
That's correct, and that's something that the drug companies have also known about since actually the mid '80s.
So what's your role in that case, and what's happening with that case?
Well, we were brought into the case just recently, although it's a couple years old. The reason we were brought in is because Pfizer themselves actually interjected themselves into the case. Pfizer contacted the prosecutor there and said, here's a whole bunch of information why Zoloft is a good drug and why it doesn't cause any of these types of reactions, just in case this defendant decides to raise a quote-unquote Zoloft defense.
Right.
Now, Pfizer entered into the case voluntarily years before we were ever involved, and when we heard that they were feeding positive information to the prosecutor, we felt compelled we needed to also let the prosecutor know about the negative sides of Zoloft. So that's why we're here.
Okay. Do a little sort of prognosticating here. What kind of future do you envision if drug companies can continue unabated to develop these drugs, new ones, the old ones, advertise them deceptively, push them through giveaways to doctors, maintain their control over the FDA that's supposed to regulate them? What do you see happening to the whole society if that's allowed to continue?
Well, if it's allowed to continue, we're going to have what we've had for the past 15 or 20 years, and that is the medical profession not being properly informed about the effectiveness and the risk related to these drugs, and so prescribing medications, just constantly prescribing medications and not looking for alternative ways to deal with people's mental health problems. What I hope happens instead, and this seems to be, I hope this is the snowball growing.
Right.
Over the course of the last year, we've seen developments that we have never seen before over the course of this litigation. We've got congressional pressure now being put on the FDA and on the drug companies. There's congressional investigations going on both at the federal and state level regarding whether these manufacturers hid information, whether the FDA properly played its role. I think what they're discovering the more they look is that the drug companies have acted, and as we see, fraudulently, and that the FDA has failed to provide any effective policing of that industry. It's also raising awareness about unpublished studies, and that the data, the manipulation of data when it's actually published by the drug companies, is furthering that misperception of the effectiveness and safety of these drugs.
Right. Now, on that subject, there was a story about a week ago about two studies that were done. One, I think it was Zoloft,
mm-hmm.
that said, one said it was good, one said it was bad. The one that said it was bad was just buried.
Yeah.
Now, there was a proposal yesterday by a consortium of medical journals for the establishment of a pre-trial trial registry in which all drug trials would be registered before they were begun, and that the results would then be expected to be published, good or bad, for the drug under question. Is that a good idea? Do you support that?
Absolutely, and I think that for the future safety of consumers, I think that may be one of the best benefits that comes out of all of this controversy. If the drug companies are no longer permitted, and if it comes even just from pressure from its own industry to hide the results of their studies and present only the good side, if they're better policed by their own industry, that's a great start to stop them from continuing the fraud.
Now, do you think that we're reaching a critical mass here between congressional investigations, litigation, criminal cases, defenses based on the problems with these drugs, and whatever you think the degree of public opinion is, that the tide here can be turned back, or is the tide just going to keep rolling up the shore?
Well, those certain individuals at the FDA I mentioned are trying to continue the status quo. I think if they're removed, we'll actually see an effective change that will benefit the consumers and improve the FDA. I also think that the drug companies being looked at closer by the public is helping with regard to this class of drugs. And so I think the day and age of the SSRIs and the truth is finally coming out. It's working its way through. I don't know that we'll have as many people hopefully taking these medications. I hope they're stopped short of continuing to give them to kids, especially preschoolers. But what I'm hearing at the same time, paralleling all of this controversy, are doctors and drug companies pushing to give these kids, even to 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds, infants, and that is just unbelievable.
They give them to the mothers while they're pregnant and get them into the kids before they're born.
The babies, there's evidence now consistently showing babies coming out with exhibiting withdrawal symptoms if the mother was on Paxil.
Right.
For example.
Last night I watched a program called After Stonewall that showed a lot of people in ACT UP and other groups demonstrating through civil disobedience their displeasure with drug companies who weren't making drugs to treat AIDS or HIV/AIDS and a government that was reluctant to encourage them. Are there any parallel or related efforts outside of litigation now where people who are affected by the existence of these SSRIs who are doing things and organizing to alleviate their own situations now?
Absolutely. And litigation is really only one avenue, and a lot of people haven't been able to pursue that anyway, but there's a very large number of advocates, and that's growing at an increasing rate. The more people who are taking these drugs, the more people who are harmed by these drugs, and they are they're working together to increase their strength and their efforts in trying to educate the medical profession, the schools, senators and congressmen about these risks and the problems with the drugs.
Okay, pretty much the last question here is these drug companies are global companies, global institutions. Presumably they are encouraging people all over the world to take these drugs. What, if anything, are you involved in terms of defending against them globally?
Well, our litigation always involves their activities in other countries as well, because oftentimes that's one way that they effectively try to hide, for example, some negative results in studies. If the study was done in another country, they may not have to provide it to the FDA for certain results there. But as far as other litigation or efforts being made in European countries and other continents, absolutely. I've been contacted by numerous attorneys around the world seeking information about what's going on. They're pursuing lawsuits. I'm working directly with the attorney in the UK who's handling what they call the Paxil user group, and that is his mass of harmed, addicted Paxil patients moving together in force in their litigation over there.
It was very impressive seeing all of the people in the streets in that movie last night. Is there any plan to get your 2,000 to 4,000 plaintiffs and have them march on the court?
Actually, I got an email last week about some of the advocates are trying to organize some a visit to New York, visit to Washington. We had a similar situation at the FDA's hearing on the 2nd last February, where you had the victims, the whole stream of victims coming up and testifying. They only got 2 minutes each, but they were able to testify and tell their stories about the violence and suicide they'd witnessed or suffered from when they were when their kids or they were taking the medication.
Okay, last question. Why is this issue important to you, and how much responsibility do you feel personally for the thousands of plaintiffs you're representing and for Mrs. Witzak and for the defendant in South Carolina?
Quite a bit, and I think I didn't expect that I would be doing this as long as I have been, but now that the lawyers in the litigation have seen more than anyone else, including the regulators, because we're able to obtain those documents. And once you've seen the internal documents and really what's going on, you can't turn away. It's been an egregious fraud on the public and on the medical industry, and it's harming people every day continuously, and so we're not going to stop our efforts until this is exposed fully.
Speaking of exposing it fully, is the media covering it enough?
A hell of a lot more than they have been before this past year, thankfully, and we try to do what we can to utilize the media to get the word out to those victims out there that don't realize that it's not them, their problems causing their suicidality, for example. It could very well be the antidepressants they're taking.
Okay, good, and you're helping by talking to us today, so thank you for that, and I'll let you get back to litigating, and we'll put this interview up and put some links to your site, and right. People listening here can get in touch with you if they want.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, bye.